If I want to compute a two-point correlator, ground state correlator, with two such operators, then if I multiply this out, there'll be four terms, but only the term with an a in the x1 and an a dagger in the x2 contributes. If I had an A here, it would annihilate the ket, and likewise, an A dagger annihilates a bra when it appears just right of the bra. To compute a two-point function, you just take the coefficient of A on the left and the coefficient of A dagger on the right. Now, Wick's theorem in this context says the following. If I have an odd correlator, so this was the case of a two-point correlator, if I have an odd correlator, I always get zero. And if I have an even correlator, then the expectation value is the sum of contractions. So you just sum over all ways of contracting the operators in pairs. You'll have some like this with many terms. I think 2n factorial over n factorial squared terms. What each term in the sum represents is a product of two-point functions. So this contraction stands for some product of two-point correlators. You know, this term stands for a different product of two-point correlators. And so on. So this would be alpha 1 beta 2 star. The way to find it, no star. Alpha 3 beta 4 dot 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 plus alpha 1 beta 3 alpha 2 beta 4 dot 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 plus many more terms. It's not hard to prove this statement. This is Wick's theorem. To prove it by induction, it just comes from, you can think of this two-point function as being the commutator that you get when you push an A past an A dagger. So if I have an expectation value with 2n operators, then if I start with x1, I can just forget about the coefficient of A dagger there. And then if I push the A through, I pick up a commutator when I push it past, when I push the A through to annihilate the ket, I get a commutator when I push it past each of these operators. And each such commutator gives one contraction. The contribution from that commutator is a contraction of the x1 with one of the other operators times an endpoint function of order 2n minus 2 that you compute by induction. It's not too hard to give an inductive proof of this statement. This generalizes to a QFT. Where if I have a sequence of operators which are linear combinations of AK and A minus K dagger, then the contraction or the two-point function just has a delta function. Forcing the total momentum of the operator to be equal. So an even correlator still splits as the sum of many contractions, but the contraction has this momentum conserving delta function. That's it. I was using these statements without defining them very well last time. Okay. The expressions that one gets in QFT for things like the interaction picture wave function usually contain time ordering. But these expressions as written apply to, you know, an arbitrary sequence of operators.
Bringing the operator forward, but if they have, but you start with time order one, and you switch them off, doesn't matter.
As an abstract operator statement, it doesn't even matter that these operators have time dependence. But we usually apply them to chains of operators that are time ordered. These statements, as written, don't require anything to be time ordered. We're building up machinery to calculate observables like 2 and 3 point correlation functions in various models of the early universe. I did a big calculation last time, and in the tutorial for today, I prepared a similar calculation. In the meantime, I'm going to, before going on and doing more complicated examples, I thought, I personally find it easier to get excited about long theory calculations in the context of some sort of observational framework. So I'm just going to do like sort of an informal lecture today about the basic observational picture in cosmology. Otherwise, I'm probably going to throw around terms like F and L parameters, power spectra, et cetera, without really having said what they meant. So this lecture is mostly informal, but it will get a little mathy when I talk about the EB decomposition for polarization. I'll give a homework problem on the EB decomposition, asking you to prove some statements that I'll state in class without proof. But for the most part, this is kind of an informal lecture, so you can mostly just sort of sit back and watch. I was told that if I prayed to the Lord God, he would produce a projector screen here. See if that's true. Amazing. Let's see if the So I'm just going to show slides for maybe 5 minutes just to show a few pictures. So I'm sure you've seen a picture like this before. This is the cosmic microwave background where a detector has looked in different directions on the sky and observed a CMB temperature. The fluctuations from point to point, this is after subtraction of the 2.7 Kelvin monopole and the 3 millikelvin dipole below those much larger signals. There are these little fluctuations with a characteristic size of 100 micro K. When we Fourier transform this map and square, we get the power spectrum, which contains almost all of the cosmological information. So most people that think about the CMB, you know, this is the first picture that pops into their head. This red curve is the theory prediction, which is sensitive to all sorts of interesting cosmological parameters. The blue points are the current measurements. To the extent that this field is a Gaussian field, the two-point function contains all of the information, all the statistical information. The statement, but looking for deviations from Gaussian statistics, is one of the more interesting observational probes that we have of the early universe. So far, those tests have all returned consistency with Gaussian statistics. And this is something that's been tested observationally to very high precision. The statement that this map is Gaussian has been tested in a variety of ways, and all the tests show consistency with Gaussian statistics at about the 0.1% level. We recently entered an era of interesting measurements of CMB polarization. So CMB polarization is a headless vector, or a little line, linear polarization. At each point on the round sky, each point of a two-sphere, circular polarization is cosmologically absent. The first thing that I need to tell you is that CMB polarization has an EB decomposition. E modes and B modes are the analog of, if you had a vector field, a field with direction, then there would be a gradient curl decomposition. And the EB decomposition is the mathematical analog of that for a field of headless vectors. So I'll define it better, I'll define it properly, but in the meantime, here's a little cartoon that may help give some intuition of the difference between an E mode, which doesn't have a particular handedness, and a B mode, which does. The E modes contain cosmological information which is qualitatively similar to temperature. So these theory predictions and measurements of, these are current measurements of the TE cross-correlation and the EE autocorrelation. They look, you know, kind of qualitatively similar to the temperature. They have the same sequence of wiggles, the same exponential damping out at high L. It's a much smaller signal, a few microkelvin rather than order 100 microkelvin, which is why it's taken longer to measure, and these types of measurements are just starting to appear with high accuracy. Oh, yeah, sorry. So I said that I was plotting the power spectrum, which in the temperature case is, you know, what you get if I take a Fourier mode at some wave number L and square it, I get the temperature power spectrum. When I throw E mode polarization in the mix, there are now two things I can do. I can take the square of an E Fourier mode, or I can multiply T by a T by an E and look for a expectation value, which would be a correlation between the two fields. So because power spectra are quadratic quantity, there's one power spectrum for every way of pairing up fields. Okay. The reason that the EB, oh wait, sorry, skipped a slide. This slide is just making the point that temperature and E-mode power spectra, the detailed shape of all these wiggles depends on cosmological parameters. And in fact, our strongest constraints on most cosmological parameters just come directly for the CMB. So here's a plot from the most recent Planck paper just showing how, with various combinations of temperature and polarization and E-mode power spectra, one can constrain all of the parameters in the standard cosmological model, typically to around 1%. B modes. The reason that the EB decomposition is powerful is because of a theorem that says that to first order in perturbation theory, so in an approximation where the initial fluctuations are small, scalar sources, such as the inflaton field, which is a scalar, do not generate B-mode polarization. Another theorem, this theorem is also, I guess, making some assumptions about symmetry. It's assuming that the physics is translation invariant, rotation invariant, and parity invariant. But given those facts, that the initial fluctuations are small, that the physics has translation, rotation, and parity symmetry, and that all the sources in the initial conditions, the sources of the initial fluctuations are scalars. You don't need to know anything about the physics. This theorem is true by a general symmetry argument that I'll present. So B modes are small. They arise only from second order effects and non-scalar sources. Another theorem is that if the only thing I assume about the physics is parity invariance, then I guess I need to actually assume rotation invariance around the Earth. Those two assumptions, the TB, I said there was a power spectrum for every way of pairing up two fields, but parity invariance forces the TB and EB cross power spectra to be zero. So the only power spectrum in town for B modes is BB. So in slow roll single field inflation, the main sources of B modes are gravity waves from inflation. If inflation is producing a stochastic background of gravity waves, because gravity waves are tensors, they're not scalars, then they evade this theorem and produce B mode polarization. And then the other thing that produces B mode polarization is second order effects. The largest second order effect turns out to be gravitational lensing. When we observe, we think of CMB polarization, or the CMB generally, as observations of the last scattering surface. And that's true at leading order. But at second order, we observe the last scattering surface through a bunch of structure that is formed in the late universe and created gravitational lenses. So I have a gravitational lens where I look in some direction. I think I see I think I'm looking at the last scattering surface here, but the gravitational lenses have deflected things so that I'm really looking at it here, and that moves points around in the map. Okay, so gravitational lensing, it's a second order effect because the effect is schematically a fluctuation on the last scattering surface times a gravitational lensing fluctuation. So gravitational lensing is a second order effect that produces a guaranteed B mode signal, and I'll show that signal in a minute. This is the leading foreground for measuring gravity waves. So because gravitational lensing is small, it's a second order effect, B mode polarization is also small. Its characteristic size is on the order of 100 nanok. And very instrumentally challenging to measure. The observations of B mode polarization are just only now getting to the interesting regime, but potentially a very powerful probe of gravity waves because the foreground is so small. Here are some plots. So in the upper plot, ignore the error bars, which are forecasts. This is just a random paper I pulled off the web, and they were forecasting some specific experiment. These aren't the current measurements. So this shows, so the big bump that you see out here at high L is the guaranteed background of B modes from gravitational lensing. And then on top of that, there is a low L bump. Actually two low L bumps, whose amplitude is a free parameter corresponding to the size of the gravity wave background produced during inflation. That's parameterized by this number R that I'll define in a minute. If R is large enough, we can pick out this characteristic wiggles of low L, we can pick them out above the gravitational lensing foreground. And there's a huge observational campaign to do this. This plot summarizes some recent measurements that were certainly getting a lot of attention. This experiment, Bicep 2 Keck, initially reported a B mode power spectrum that looked like the black points here, which did indeed show precisely the L ranges in these plots are different, you know. A different range and also a different plotting axis. But if you kind of mentally shift this to the top figure, the shape that you see here, this bump, looks very much like a gravity wave signal appearing above the gravitational lensing foreground, which is what's shown here in red. However, after many more months of analysis using extra information about galactic dust polarization that came out in the meantime. These results were revised to the blue points, which are consistent with the gravitational lensing signal alone. It's actually a very interesting measurement of the gravitational lensing signal, the best measurement, which is kind of observationally interesting. But there's currently no evidence for gravity waves in B-mode polarization. Okay. So that's all the cartoons I wanted to show, just so that you have a sense of the various power spectra that are being measured and roughly what their shape looks like. Okay. God, I'm all finished with the. Oh, he's one step ahead of me. yeah.
Why does dust affect the demo
cost factor? Oh, yeah. So there's no reason why. So dust emits microwave polarization at a low level. The physics of that is actually quite complicated. So there are magnetic fields in the galaxy. And if I have little dust grains, which are not perfectly circular but have some ellipticity, they tend to line up with the magnetic field. The physics of that process is actually not particularly well understood. And then if the dust grain has a, this probably isn't what you're asking. okay. And if the an elliptical dust grain that's sitting in space with some preferred orientation, which has a non-zero temperature, will vibrate, and the vibrational emission, the vibrational modes of the dust grain, will produce linear polarization. There's no reason why the symmetry arguments, which apply to the whole universe, those symmetry arguments that say that I only get E modes, they depend on a high degree of symmetry, the ability to translate the universe around, the ability to rotate the universe. And that's those assumptions are totally violated when we are observing from the center of our galaxy with some, you know, peculiar non-rotationally invariant structure. This emission mechanism produces linear polarization, which has comparable amplitudes in E and B. Okay. So now I'm going to talk a little bit about the observational big picture. You've probably heard that we have a standard cosmological model. So it's kind of amazing that 30 plus years of observations can be summarized by the statement that all of our data can be fit by a model with the following six parameters. Let me tell you what the parameters mean. So three of the parameters are the expansion history, which we already defined when we were talking about the FRW metric. The next two parameters define the initial fluctuations. So the initial fluctuations are in our standard cosmological model are adiabatic, scalar, Gaussian, power law initial conditions. Here's what those words mean. Adiabatic scalar. Means that, now by initial conditions in the standard cosmological model, I mean the state of the universe just after inflation ended, but at the very beginning of the radiation-dominated era. So I'll sometimes describe that state of the universe as final conditions when I'm talking about inflation, but I'll call these initial conditions when I'm talking about the standard cosmological model. At that point in the universe's evolution, the metric of the universe is this FRW metric with a perturbation that just goes here. Where this function zeta is called the adiabatic curvature. At least early in the universe's evolution, before much evolution has happened, it's a function of space but not time. And furthermore, there are formulas for determining all of the matter fluctuations in terms of this one field, the adiabatic curvature. So there are formulas for determining, for example, the fluctuation in the dark matter density is some function, actually just a constant, times the adiabatic curvature. Some numerical constant times the adiabatic curvature. And so on for the other components of the universe, the photon abundance, the neutrino abundance, and so on. The motivation, the physical motivation for the universe having this metric, as well as a universal set of formulas relating the adiabatic curvature which appears to the different particle species, I couldn't come up with a short, like a few minute explanation for why that's true. A nice explanation was given by Weinberg in a classic paper on adiabatic modes in cosmology that I'll talk about later. But for now, let's just suffice to say that what adiabatic scalar means is that the entire state of the universe at an early time is just determined by the single 3D field, zeta of x. That field, zeta, is a Gaussian field. What that means is that if I know the power spectrum of the field zeta, so let's write its power spectrum or two-point function. Assuming translation invariance, the two-point correlator of two Fourier modes of zeta always has this delta function. And then if I'm also assuming rotation invariance, then the coefficient here, the power spectrum, just depends on the length of k. So let me put vectors over the k's here and here, but not here. So this is just a function of one variable. So this is defined. The power spectrum is defined whether or not the field is Gaussian. It's defined for any field. What Gaussian means is that the statistics of the field are fully determined by the power spectrum plus Wick's theorem. So if I compute, for example, a four-point correlator, this is one way of saying it. That just factors as the sum of three terms, where each term is a product of two-point correlators. Each one of these would have a delta function in it. So Gaussian means that all the higher point. One way of saying what a Gaussian field is it's to say that once you know the power spectrum, all the higher cumulants and any statistical question you want to ask about the field are fully pinned down. Another way of saying it, a more direct way of saying it, is that each Fourier mode of this field behaves as a statistically independent random quantity with a Gaussian distribution whose width is determined by the power spectrum. If you wanted to like randomly simulate on the computer in a box, a realization of this field, that's what you would do. You might notice that Wick's theorem has appeared in two contexts here. As a statement about expectation values of a classical random multivariate Gaussian, and also as a statement about expectation values of a harmonic oscillator. So in fact, the reason that inflation produces a Gaussian field is because it's easiest to understand why that's true by thinking about the Wick's theorem definition of what a Gaussian field means. At the end of inflation, every Fourier mode of the field is some Heisenberg picture operator, which is a linear combination of A and A dagger. And that implies that if I were to compute this by sandwiching those operators in between vacuums, that Wick's theorem would be satisfied just by this theorem that we proved, or I schematically sketched how to prove. So I think that's very physically interesting. Normally in nature, when things are Gaussian, it's because the central limit theorem has somehow applied. Like, I measured a random quantity, and it is the average of many independent random quantities and has a Gaussian distribution. But if inflation is the correct theory, the random initial fluctuations of our universe are Gaussian for a different reason, a quantum mechanical reason, which traces back to the statement that, well, one way to say it is that the early universe is just a bunch of independent harmonic oscillators. The field values that we measure at the end of inflation are just linear combinations of the creation and annihilation modes of those operators. That's a statement about harmonic oscillators. So if we had interesting interactions between particles during inflation, QFT-style interactions, then the statistics would become non-Gaussian, and that's why looking for deviations from Gaussian statistics is an interesting probe of the physics of inflation. Okay. Finally, power law. So far I've said that the initial conditions are fully described by this field. The statistics of that field are fully described by its power spectrum. I'll finish my description of the initial statistics if I tell you what the power spectrum is. So it's conventional to write it down with this factor of k cubed over 2 pi squared in front. So there's that is a power law. The amplitude and spectral index ns are defined so that, conventionally defined, so that ns equals 1 corresponds to the scale invariant case. The case where the power spectrum p is proportional to 1 over k cubed, and its statistics are invariant under rescaling. Just as an aside, let me explain why power spectra are often defined with this factor of k cubed over 2 pi squared in front. If I'm an experimenter and I ask, what is the variance of the field, the expectation value in real space at a point, of the square of the field at a point, in Fourier space, that looks like integral of d3k times the power spectrum. And if I write this as d log k, if I integrate out the angular directions and make this a 1D integral, if I write this as d log k, I have a factor of 4 pi from the angular variables, a factor of 1 over 2 pi cubed in the integral. That leaves a 1 over 2 pi squared times k cubed, k squared from the angular integrals, and one factor of k from switching to log k times p zeta. So this combination, if I ask how much variance in the field comes from a band of k's with fixed fractional width, this is the number. This is what an experimenter would think of as the amount of power coming from a given regime in k. And this is what an experimenter would want to see on the y-axis of a plot. The same argument applied for a 2D field is why when you see 2D fields, their power spectra are typically plotted as L squared over 2 pi CL. Our universe is not quite scale invariant, and observing this to be true was a huge milestone that happened in 2005, I think. The observed value is about 5 sigma different, a little bit red tilted. There's a little bit more power at low k than the scale invariant case. The final parameter is the optical depth tau. So this is the optical depth to the surface of last scattering, or the probability that a photon that starts at the surface of last scattering will scatter off a free electron before making it to us. For this to make sense, let me remind you that if I plot the ionization fraction of the universe, the probability that a random electron in the universe is ionized versus being in an atom, then that is 1 at high redshift when the universe is a plasma, goes to 0 at recombination, so this is at a redshift of around 1100. stays 0 for a long time and then comes back up to 1 at a redshift of around 6 because stars have formed and their high energy photons, their ultraviolet photons, are energetic enough to knock, to fill the universe and knock electrons out of hydrogen atoms. So the optical depth tau, which is around 0.07, is just the optical depth from these electrons. You know, this matters because the observed peak height, these scattering events isotropize the CMB. So the observed peak height in the CMB is not just proportional to delta zeta squared, which is the amplitude of the initial conditions, the power in the initial conditions, but this parameter with a factor of e to the minus 2 tau. So this is kind of an important nuisance parameter for the CMB. It's just you need to know it to translate between the height of the peaks and the actual power in the initial conditions. Okay. So when I talk about observations, I mean the CMB for now. So for these six parameters are constrained extremely well by the CMB, much more strongly by the CMB than by other probes. So you can think of the CMB as a complicated but linear black box. Which processes a realization of the initial adiabatic curvature to some observed temperature and polarization pattern on the sky. Now, to describe things on the sky, since the sky is a sphere, I'm going to use differential geometry notions to describe CMB polarization. So let eta A be. For an audience of theoretical physicists, this is totally the best language to describe it. Let sky is a sphere. So let eta A be the Euclidean 2 metric on the sphere. When I point a detector at a particular direction on the sphere, say some unit 2 vector n hat, then what I get to measure I can take the two transverse components of the electric field in that direction and correlate them. And that defines this tensor, the intensity tensor, which is just covariantly described as a rank 2 symmetric tensor on the 2-sphere. This is what we really measure, at least for a fully polarized detector. The temperature is just the trace of this tensor. It's just how much power is in the electric field after if I don't care about what a component of the field is producing the power. So the temperature is just, well, there's some factor here, which I won't write out, some blackbody factor to translate temperature into power. You need to know what frequency you're observing at and put in the blackbody spectrum. But some factor times the trace A to AB, IAB. And polarization. And linear polarization is covariantly described as the part of the intensity tensor, which is left over after removing the trace. So if I subtract off the trace, oh, look, sorry, this was supposed to be PAB. So this is a traceless symmetric tensor. That's the proper covariant description of linear polarization. When you see linear polarization depicted as a bunch of headless vectors on the sphere, a covariant description of how you get from this traceless symmetric tensor to this picture is that you know, if I go to any point, then a traceless symmetric tensor at that point, well, because it's symmetric, it always has two real eigenvalues. Because it's traceless, those two eigenvalues are plus and minus each other. And if I just plot a line in the direction of the positive eigenvalue with length equal to the positive eigenvalue itself, that's how I make this picture. Okay. So temperature is usually analyzed in harmonic space. If the sky were flat, then we would do the following. We would Fourier transform and then try to estimate the power spectrum, which in Fourier space is diagonal. Just like in the case of a 3D field, if I take the CMB temperature, that's just some random field in 2D, its two-point correlation function is constrained to be of this form with the delta function with a power spectrum, a 2D power spectrum CL, which only depends on the direction of L and not its orientation. On a spherical sky, the analog of this Fourier of the Fourier transform is the spherical harmonic decomposition. So instead of a sum of plane waves, an arbitrary function on a sphere is represented as the sum of spherical harmonics. You know, where this YLM object, the spherical harmonic, the right way to think about it, I think, is that it's an object that transforms in a simple way under rotations. Just like the plane waves are not objects that that transform in a simple way under translations. And then the two-point function that we want to, after we Fourier transform, the two-point function that we want to estimate has this. Oh, I'm sorry, I meant to write ALM here. Let's put a T on top. As in the flat sky case, the form of the two-point function is constrained by symmetry, but the right-hand side is less transparent. So I'm not going to prove this, but the most general two-point function you can have, which is in harmonic space, which is consistent with the symmetries of the sphere, the group of rotations, is diagonal in L, diagonal in M, with a coefficient that only depends on L and not M. I won't prove that, but you've probably seen this in some other context, like in quantum mechanics. You know, for example, if I have a Hamiltonian which commutes with rotations, then the way it acts on states, it has to act in such a way that preserves the value of L, preserves the value of M, and has a coefficient which can't depend on the M of the states, only the L. Okay. Now, because the CMB is a linear black box, the power spectrum contains all the information. So at the level of the maps, the CMB is processing some realization of the 3D field zeta into some linearly into some 2D field T. At the level of power spectra, what's happening is that I started with some... My zeta field was a Gaussian field, a 3D Gaussian field with some power spectrum. So that would be k cubed p zeta is the quantity that would be constant for a scale invariant field. And in our universe, that's slightly tilted in the red direction relative to scale invariant. So the CMB is some complicated black box that converts this into a series of acoustic peaks. So this is L squared CLTT. At a crude level of approximation, let me start over here. At a crude level of approximation, what's happening is that the power spectrum at multipole L is the power spectrum of the initial zeta evaluated at wave number L over D times some transfer function which encodes the physics of the plasma, the way that a 3D wave of wave number k is either amplified or suppressed by the plasma physics, also evaluated at wave number L over D. So if, for example, I were to put like a little feature here in the initial power spectrum, I were to put a little bump, that would show up as a little bump somewhere in the CLs, somewhere in the power spectrum of our CMB, at a location which is equal to the wave number k0, where I place the bump, times d, where I forgot to say that d is the distance to last scattering. D is distance to the last scattering surface which is about 14,000 megaparsecs. So what's happening here is that if I'm looking at the CMB fluctuations, if I'm looking out at the last scattering surface, then if I put a plane wave in the initial conditions, you know, here are the troughs and crests of that wave, with some wave number k, so the spacing here would be like 2 pi over k, then when I observe that same pattern of troughs and crests imprinted as hot and cold regions in the last scattering surface, then that shows up as a temperature fluctuation with a characteristic wave number equal to k times d. The d is just translating between a 3D distance in the plasma and an angle on the last scattering surface. You can also see from this description that in a cosmology with curvature, I would put the angular diameter distance here. So this cartoon sort of shows you how features in the initial conditions or the power spectrum of the initial conditions sort of imprint themselves as features in the CMB on a one-to-one basis. Now, the wiggles that are actually observed, of course, are not wiggles in the initial conditions. They're in the transfer function. So the T of K here contains the wiggles in K that you see in the plot. And though the transfer function is a sensitive function of late of cosmological parameters, the parameters of the model, which are not describing the initial fluctuations, the expansion history parameters, and tau. So I have to tell you about the EB decomposition. I don't think I have quite enough time, but we'll do half of it. Okay. So the EB decomposition, I want to define it properly. It's easy to kind of use it in a hand-wavy way. I'd like to define it properly and prove why the symmetry theorems are true. So let me start by asking, what is the analog of the spherical harmonic decomposition? Spherical transform. For a traceless symmetric two tensor. There are two notations in common use for CMB linear polarization. There's the tensor notation, which I'm using, and then there's also the mathematical framework of spin S fields on the sphere. The tensor notation, I think, is easier to understand if you have the GR toolkit, and it's also easiest to prove the symmetry theorems and the basic properties of the decomposition in a ground-up way without assuming anything. The other formalism, the spin S formalism, is probably more convenient for calculations. So if you want to do hardcore calculations, like what B-mode pattern do I get if I observe an E-mode pattern through a gravitational lens, then you may want to study the spin S formalism. I'm not planning to do this sort of like nitty-gritty phenomenology calculations. I think the tensor formalism I personally find much more transparent. Let's answer this question in the flat sky first. In the flat sky, I don't need to worry so much about describing things in an indexed covariant way. I can just pull out components, just like, I decompose a vector field into its x and y components. I can take this. Symmetric traceless tensor and write it with two components. There are these two, a component Q times this basis traceless symmetric tensor, plus a component U times this traceless symmetric tensor. This is the definition, the usual definition of the QU Stokes parameters in E&M. So in the flat sky where I'm just doing Fourier transforms, of course you have two numbers for each wave number L. QL and UL by Fourier transforming the two Stokes parameters. So these are Stokes parameters. But a more interesting decomposition into two numbers for every L is to define for each L a number EL and a number BL by applying this little 2x2 rotation matrix. Where phi L is just the angle that your wave vector L made with the x-axis. Now, why is this more interesting? Because it's rotation invariant. If an observer, if I analyze the same physical pattern of polarization in a rotating coordinate system, so suppose I come along and use a coordinate system which is rotated relative to the original by some axis theta, then that, let's see, that transforms phi prime to phi minus theta. And it also rotates Q into U. So, you know, an observer that sees pure Q polarization, linear polarization, that just means that the axis of linear polarization is lined up with the axis of their coordinate system. A rotated observer, in a rotated frame, that will not be true. They'll see some combination of Q and U. It's not too hard to convince yourself that the primed observer sees a polarization pattern which is rotated like this. There's a factor of two. You know, the two theta appears instead of the theta because polarization is a rank two tensor and there are two indices to rotate. And so if you put in this rotation matrix, then this factor of theta cancels this factor of theta, and the primed and unprimed observers see the same E and B. In other words, E and B just transform like scalar quantities under rotation. The rotation is preserving the EB decomposition. Another thing which is true, another thing which is interesting about the EB decomposition, which is going to be the basis for the symmetry theorems, is that under a parity transformation, so I said that E and B transform as scalars under rotations. If I throw parity reversing transformations into the mix, then E transforms as a scalar under parity, and B transforms as a pseudoscalar. There's an extra minus sign. You can see that's true if you choose the parity operation, which is just leaving the x-axis flipped and leaving the x-axis fixed and flipping the y direction. That reverses the sign of phi. And it also reverses the sign of U, but not Q. If you put in those signs into this definition of E and B, you'll see that the parity transformation is reversing B, but not E. Okay, so I'll start off next time. I'm almost done with my little mini lecture on observations. I'll start off next time by defining the EB decomposition on a curved sky. And then I'll talk about the bottom line for the observational bottom line for inflation. All right. See you guys tomorrow.